We're on national defense still, chapter 11. Islamic jihadism, I think that, sadly, and I think it's a sobering fact, that the greatest threat to the United States today, the greatest threat of attack, comes from an international terrorist movement that's called different things, but I'm calling it Islamic jihadism. It's a term that refers to the view of a number of loosely related groups in different countries. In Pakistan and Afghanistan, we have a number of people who are members of the Taliban or the Al-Qaeda terrorist group. The Hamas group is in Gaza. The Hezbollah group is in Lebanon and to some extent in Syria. And the Muslim Brotherhood group is in Egypt. These groups all have the idea that you can use violence to advance the rule of Islam throughout different nations of the world. And I think today it's the single greatest threat to American peace and security. That says December 2011. That should say, I'm jumping the gun a little bit. That outline, line three should say December 2010. It's not 2011 until another 11 days, I think. And my argument this morning, I want to give some background to this because I think we just have to understand where it came from and what the causes are. Some people say, oh, it's poverty in third world countries and that's the cause for this. And my argument this morning is going to be the causes for Islamic jihadism, the cause is not poverty in third world countries, and it's not government actions by the United States that we've done something evil, but rather the cause is an evil religious belief that any violent means to advance Islamic domination are justified. Now I want to go into a little bit of the background of especially Al-Qaeda, but this entire Islamic jihadism movement. And I'm going to be using a book called The Looming Tower. The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11 by a man named Lawrence Wright. And this has an amazingly detailed bunch of information about the background to Islamic jihadism. Lawrence Wright said the theory that you can use violence to advance Islam goes back. Abdul Wahhab, 1703 to 1792, was a Muslim teacher and kind of a Muslim revival speaker. He lived in what's now today Saudi Arabia. And he taught that his followers could, if there were people that didn't obey his teachings, Wahhab's teachings, he told his followers, you can kill and rape and steal from people who don't agree with me. I haven't ever adopted that viewpoint in my classes, actually, but it was kind of shocking. But there he is teaching this in the mid-1700s. So notice, at the same time in history that God is raising up the United States of America, 1776, to be a beacon for freedom and light throughout the world, there's evil of a very, very destructive sort arising in the world with this Abdul Wahhab. He claimed that men shouldn't trim their beards. There's no difference between religion and government. And sometimes people who follow his teachings today are called Wahhabi Muslims or Wahhabism. So his ideas bounced around, and a lot of Muslims didn't follow him. But there was a man in Egypt who came along in the 1950s and began to preach this Wahhabism, this idea that you could use violence to advance Islam. Lawrence Wright, throughout this book, says this advancing Islam by terrorism, it really is, and he says has been for centuries, a minority view among Muslims. And the world is full of countries that have many millions of Muslims who don't hold to this. In Indonesia, in Turkey, in Pakistan, although I know there's a lot of violence in Pakistan now, and in a number of Arab countries. But Saeed Qutb, Q-U-T-B, 1906 to 1966, was a prominent writer in Egypt. And here's a younger picture of him, and then an older picture when he was in jail. And Qutb gained some prominence as a kind of a writer, and a writer about Islam, and a writer about the progress of things in society, and writing about the government. And he became appointed to a leadership role in the Ministry of Education in Egypt. But then, in 1948, he came to the United States to do some further education. I came to the United States in 1948 also, when I was born. But 1948 is important. The nation of Israel was just founded. Qutb sailed in a first-class cabin on a cruise liner from Alexandria, Egypt, to come to the United States. He landed in late November, early December of 1948. The United States was in a post-war recovery boom. Everybody was happy, prosperous, high employment. Everybody who wanted a job could get one. People were spending money. It was the Christmas season. He was horrified. He thought, this is materialism. This is evil, and he was repulsed by New York City, even though he was a wealthy, educated Egyptian. Then he went to Washington, D.C. for further study, and he didn't like that very much either. Then he went to Greeley, Colorado to do more study, and it was kind of a idyllic Midwestern community at that time, and white picket fences around all the houses, and it was beautiful. But he became hardened in his opposition to what he saw as ungodliness, materialism, sexual immorality. This is 1948 in the United States, which was still quite a conservative time. So Qutb went back to Egypt, and he was looking at the Egyptian government, and he was saying, they're not enforcing Islamic law. They're not strict enough. Who's the responsible party? It's Gamal Nasser, the head of the government in Egypt. And so Qutb became part of a group called the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and he began to edit their magazine. And some members of the Muslim Brotherhood said, well, you know, we're going to fix this. This Nasser, who's not enforcing Islamic law on everybody and forcing everybody to conform to Islamic practice in Egypt, we've had enough of him. So they tried to assassinate Nasser, and they failed. But Qutb was arrested because he was connected with this group, and he was put in prison. And he stayed in prison for 11 years and was mistreated and beaten and tortured, I guess, by the pro-government forces in Egypt. But he kept writing about how they should use violence to promote Islam. And he wrote this book called Milestones. It was smuggled out of the prison in Cairo, and it was published in 1964, and it began to spread. He got out of prison in 1964, but he was soon arrested again and was charged with conspiracy to overthrow the government, and he was hanged and died in 1966. But his influence continues today in his writings promoting violence to advance Islam, and he really became a martyr for people who supported that cause. So that's Qutb, kind of the modern leader of these ideas, but not at all from a poor background. Highly educated, medium to high government official, trained in the United States of all things. But he just didn't like whatever he saw about the United States. Then we go to Ayman al-Zawahiri, born in 1951. Top of his class in medical school. Became a surgeon, well established as a doctor. in Egypt. Zawahiri began to be influenced by Qutb's writings and these ideas of violence. And he was involved in a group that started to plot against the government. And Anwar Sadat, the head of government in Egypt, was assassinated in October 6, 1981. I don't know if you remember the video of that. He stood at attention and this jeep veered away from the military procession and a guy just shot a machine gun at him and assassinated Sadat. That was Muslim Brotherhood, Islamic jihadist terrorism active in Egypt in 1981. But, you know, tried to assassinate Nasser in 1954. So we're not, the reason I'm doing this is saying this September 11th, 2001, the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, this didn't come out of nowhere. It's been brewing back here in a minority strain of Islamic thought for decades, if not for centuries. Well, Sadat was assassinated. Zawahiri was arrested and put in Egyptian prison, severely tortured in his Egyptian prison. And there were 300 people implicated in the plot, the assassination of Anwar Sadat. And Zawahiri became the spokesman for these 300 prisoners. And at the trial, which went on a long time, he was kind of the spokesman haranguing the government and blaming it for not being sufficiently Islamic. Zawahiri was released from prison in 1984. So Sadat was assassinated in 81. The trial went on for, I don't know, two years, December 4th, 1982 to 1984. And he was released. And what did he do? He didn't stay in Egypt. I don't know if he thought it wasn't safe for him anymore. But he went to Saudi Arabia, and then he went to Afghanistan, and he met somebody else. Osama bin Laden, who's 6 years younger than Zawahiri. Bin Laden was born to an extremely wealthy family in Saudi Arabia. His father, Mohammed bin Laden, had a huge construction company, had built most of the roads, the major roads in Saudi Arabia, had built most of the major mosques, including the Grand Mosque in Medina in Saudi Arabia. And when bin Laden was in high school, he joined the Muslim Brothers, this kind of radical Islamic group. He went to university in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, and studied economics, but he wasn't too interested in economics. He was interested in this very extreme religious group that he found, Islamic group that he found in university. He did a few other things with his family business. His share of the family business was about $7 million. And in addition to that, he had substantial annual income. So he's a multimillionaire, or was, before he spent most of it. And he was committed to advancing Islam through violent means. So he eventually traveled various places, but he went to Saudi Arabia, and he found that, and he went out of Saudi Arabia, he went to Afghanistan. And in Afghanistan, he found these loyal, devoted Muslims trying to drive out the Russians. And so he joined with them, and the United States thought, you know, we want the Russians out of Afghanistan too. So we were quietly giving help to bin Laden and others. But once the Russians were gone, bin Laden turned against the United States, thinking it was an enemy of Islam. Why did these men turn against America? Says Lawrence Wright in The Looming Tower. In large part, it was because they saw America as the locus of Christian power. To them, that is bin Laden and Zawahiri, to them, the Christianity was not just a rival, it was the arch enemy. To them, the Crusades were a continual historical process that would never be resolved until the final victory of Islam. Bin Laden and his Arab Afghans believed that in Afghanistan they had turned the tide. Islam was again on the march, and they had the Taliban ruling in Afghanistan, enforcing strict Islamic law. Now, what happened in Afghanistan? What did strict Islamic law look like? What were they aiming at? Here's what life was like. For women, work was prohibited. Schooling was prohibited for women. And this, says Lawrence Wright, destroyed the healthcare system. You take all the women out of the healthcare system, they're not working anymore. What happened to your healthcare system? Destroyed. Destroyed the civil service. Eliminated elementary education because the great majority of teachers were women, but they weren't allowed to work anymore. The Taliban prohibited kite flying. Too joyful. Dog racing. Banned satellite dishes, so you couldn't watch television on satellite anymore. Movies. Any equipment that produced the joy of music. They outlawed pool tables. They outlawed chess. That's a game. Can't do that. Outlawed alcohol. Outlawed computers, VCRs, television. Outlawed nail polish. It wouldn't bother me a lot, but I know a lot of people it would bother, like Margaret. Outlawed sewing catalogs. Outlawed photographs. Outlawed Christmas cards, of course. For men, if your beard wasn't longer than the grip of your hand, you went to jail. Woman, if you leave home without a veil, your home will be marked and your husband punished. How'd you like to live in a country like that? That's the strict imposition of Islamic law or Sharia law that actually happened under the Taliban in Afghanistan. Just incredible dehumanization and oppression of people. It's the opposite of freedom, isn't it? It's the opposite of having the right to what our Declaration of Independence says, God-given right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Let's say you want to pursue happiness by playing some music, or watching a movie, or flying a kite, or playing chess. You can't pursue happiness in that way. It's the opposite of the kind of government that the United States was set up to give freedom for people. It was tremendously oppressive kind of slavery, basically. So Lawrence Wright says, these people in Afghanistan were returning to the rule of Sharia law or Islamic law that governed all of life. Even the values that America advertised as being universally desirable, democracy, transparency, the rule of law, human rights, separation of religion from government, these were Western ideas in the eyes of the jihadis, and they were opposed. Zawahiri, now remember, brilliant, intellectually brilliant man, began to adopt an extreme interpretation of the Quran or of Islam known as Takfir, T-A-K-F-I-R. Is that on the outline? Oh yeah, number 8. This idea is that violence is justified. See, you've got this statement in the Quran that says you can't put anybody to death except for the crime of murder or adultery or religious apostasy, turning away from the true religion. And now Zawahiri is saying, well, who's apostatizing? Well, if you vote in an election, you're endorsing democracy rather than Islamic law. So you're apostate. So we can put you to death. Just for voting. Say nothing of running for office. So now you imagine with that kind of background in Afghanistan, the courage of people who went to vote after the Taliban had been defeated in Afghanistan and to vote in these democratic elections. It's a complete 180 degree turn, but you still got people in the country who say, you participate, you die. It's quite amazing. It's tragic. It's shocking. So Takfir, says Lawrence Wright, is the mirror image of, or the opposite of, what majority of Islam teach, or of Muslims teach. because majority of Muslims say Muslims shouldn't kill anyone except, and in some cases they say except as punishment for murder. But they wanted to kill people for these other causes. Anybody who registered to vote then was thought to be apostate and was worthy of death. And then, number seven in your outline, August 11th, 1988, they formed an organization called Al-Qaeda, Q-A-E-D-A, and in Arabic that means the base. And this would be the base for the future society, perfect society based on Islam that they were going to establish. And their goal, they decided, well, we're not big enough to overthrow governments directly. What we'll do is we'll launch terrorist attacks against civilians, against innocent civilians, not against soldiers. And they would concentrate not on fighting armies, but killing civilians primarily in the nation that was the biggest barrier to Islamic rule throughout the whole world. What nation would that be?
Us guys.
That would be the United States. And so their goal was to kill Americans, not just soldiers, but civilians in America, because America was the only power capable of blocking, they thought, the restoration of the ancient Islamic rule or Islamic caliphate or government throughout the world. And America had to be defeated. Now, I don't want to minimize this. What this means is, this is a struggle for world domination. That is the goal of the founders of Al-Qaeda. That is the goal of Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden. Their goal is world domination with the kind of Sharia law, Islamic law, that we saw in Afghanistan when the Taliban was in power. What is number 11 on the outline? What is a biblical perspective to this? My response is this. Although militant Muslims frequently refer to the United States as the Great Satan, it seems to me evident that the movement truly motivated by Satan himself is such a movement as this Islamic jihadism that would justify killing anyone who disagrees with it. Jesus said Satan was a murderer from the beginning, John 8:44. He was a murderer from the beginning. Satan wants to destroy human beings and destroy the lives of people created in the image of God. And a movement that believes it right to murder all who disagree, I think shows that its deepest spiritual motivation, what gives it its power, is not God, but demonic forces that are opposed to God and to His truth. If such Sharia law is implemented in nations, it results in an intolerable loss of human freedom. It reduces human beings to dehumanizing slavery. It's a work of Satan, not a work of God. Jesus said, I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. And Jesus said, that's John 10:10. And Jesus said in Luke 4:18, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because He has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives, to set at liberty those who are oppressed. Jesus came giving liberty or freedom, and these Islamic teachers are just bringing slavery and oppression. So I've gone into the background of this because I do not want you to be fooled by people in American society or European society or the European or American press who say, the reason we were attacked on 9/11 is because there's so much poverty and oppression in the world. The United States is the economic leader of the world and we must be oppressing these people in poor countries. Not at all. Qutb, Zawahiri, bin Laden were well-educated and well-to-do. Bin Laden, as I said, was a multimillionaire. And most young men who went to Afghanistan to join them in this Al-Qaeda cause, most young men were middle or upper class, largely college-educated, the majority of them in science and engineering. Amazing. So the explanation for Al-Qaeda and these other terrorist movements is a profoundly religious explanation and a religious motivation. The idea that they must use murder and terrorism to advance the rule of Islamic law by force through the nations of the world. In addition, there's another factor, and that is radical Islamic opposition to Israel, to the existence of Israel as a nation. I'll come back to this a few weeks from now. But you have the Middle East filled with Islamic countries, more or less strict, and then in the middle of it, you've got Israel, a Jewish nation, and many Muslim leaders say that Israel has no right to exist, and they won't rest until the Jews are driven out of Palestine and driven into the sea, so that pure Islamic rule can be established throughout the Middle East. Islamic scholar Nahal Sahin Uktu says this: history has shown that the Palestinian land, the promised land of God, really belongs to the descendants of Abraham. Oh, we say, that sounds good. And he's quoting what he says from the Torah, the Jewish Bible. However, he said, the promised land doesn't belong to the descendants of Abraham who came through Isaac, but those who descended from Ismail, one of whom was the prophet Muhammad. So the Arabic people coming through Abraham's son by Hagar, Ishmael, really deserve the promised land, is what they're saying. 1998, number 16 on your outline, there was a fatwa, a formal religious declaration, saying that they have a responsibility, that people have a responsibility to kill Americans and their allies, civilian and military. It's a duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible. Why? They don't like American troops in Saudi Arabia, even though the Saudi Arabian government had asked and blessed our presence there. They didn't like American action in Iraq in the first Gulf War, and they don't like American support of Israel. So, point B on your outline. Now I'm going to give you an alternative explanation. In the political world in the United States, this alternative is the liberal view of why we have terrorist attacks. And this liberal view is the opposite view. It blames the United States again and again for these terrorist attacks. No kidding. And there are voices out here who repeatedly blame the United States. And I have mentioned before, I didn't bring it with me this morning, but I've mentioned before this book by Jim Wallace, W-A-L-L-I-S, God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It, best-selling book, very influential in liberal political circles in the United States. And I went through Jim Wallace's book and said, why does he think that we had these terrorist attacks? Well, at one place in one sentence in the book on page 99, he says, correctly, that this is motivated by the ambition of a perverted religious fundamentalism for regional and global power. But that brief sentence is not at all central to Wallace's argument, nor is it emphasized. In his overall discussion of terrorism, Wallace minimizes the religious causes and points again and again to American shortcomings, blaming the United States for terrorist attacks. Here's a quote. What should we do? He said, an even more courageous national commitment, that's on our part, would be to face honestly the grievances and injustices that breed rage and vengeance and are continually exploited by terrorists to recruit the angry and the desperate. It is impossible to comprehend adequately the terrorist acts of September 11th without a deeper understanding of the grievances and injustices felt by millions of people around the world. And again in Wallace's book, he says, look at these grievances and injustices that give rise to terrorism. United States support for military dictators. United States failure to be an honest broker for Middle East peace. American and Western appetites for oil. And the great crime, the United States is wealthy. It sits atop and is leader of a global economy in which half of God's children still live on less than $2 a day. Implication is, that's our fault. He says, we have contributed to the grievances and injustices that breed terrorism. Page 101, see also 104, 105, 106. Again and again, Wallace returns to this blame America theme, saying that the real way to solve terrorism is global poverty reduction. Now, my answer to that is global poverty reduction would not have changed the mind of multimillionaire Osama bin Laden or wealthy educator and writer Saeed Qutb or wealthy surgeon, prominent surgeon Zawahiri. But Wallace says our military attacks, you know, he said, when we go and attack and fight against terrorists in Iraq or Afghanistan, you know what? That's just adding to the problem. Because it leads to them recruiting more terrorists and an unending cycle of violence. In other words, he comes back to this pacifist theme that if you use military force against evil, it just makes them more violent and more evil. Violence leads to violence, leads to violence. His solution is pacifism and financial aid to the poor terrorists or countries that where there's terrorism. So I disagree with this argument that our military attacks help the terrorists. He's really saying when we defeat terrorists militarily, it helps them recruit more. Another way of putting this argument is to say that winning is actually losing. When you defeat people militarily, you just help them. I just think that's backwards. It's the opposite of Romans 13:4, which says, the government does not bear the sword in vain. He is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. But I want you to understand, if you meet somebody who says, you know, it's the fault of the United States, we're not helping solve poverty in the world enough. That's why we have these terrorist attacks. I want you to understand that that kind of argument really can never be satisfactorily answered to the people who promote it. Because there's always going to be poverty in the world, someplace. And so every time we say, well, we need more military power to defeat terrorism, they will say, no, we need to give more to the poor around the world. And it always allows a pacifist to change the subject from military defense against evil to attacking the people who are harmed, to attacking the United States. The entire force of Jim Wallace's discussion is to turn the victim, the United States, into the culprit. And so the existence of poverty anywhere in the world gives Wallace a basis for accusing the United States of wrongdoing. He just brings up world poverty to argue how evil the United States is. And the result of that kind of argument is to undermine any sense of moral right and wrong in this whole argument. You see, the United States is evil, the United States is evil, and you say, well, wait a minute, you know, I know there's something wrong with our country too, we're not perfect. And all of a sudden, it blurs everything, and you can't see who's right and wrong. My response is, not that the United States is a perfect nation, there's a lot wrong with our nation, and I've criticized a lot in our nation over the weeks that I've taught here. But I am saying, in the specific matter of the attacks by Islamic terrorists, there was a clear moral right and wrong. Terrorists who attack innocent civilians, as at the World Trade Center, are wrong. Military actions that try to stop such attacks are morally good with regard to that particular issue. I think Wallace just muddies the waters. All right, point C. Another argument showing that 9/11 didn't just happen out of the blue. Look at what happened leading up to this. February 26, 1993, there was a bomb at the basement of the World Trade Center in the parking garages that tried to blow it up and bring it down. It failed, but that was an attack. June 25, 1996, bombing of Khobar Towers, a military barracks in Saudi Arabia, U.S. barracks. August 7, 1998, bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya. August 7, 1998, bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Somebody asked me recently to go to Dar es Salaam. Interestingly, I'm thinking about it. October 12, 2000, bombing of the USS Cole, the Navy ship, in a port in Yemen. And then September 11, 2001, the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. The attacks on 9/11 didn't appear out of the blue. These are a series of militant actions against the United States beginning at least 8 years earlier, in 93, with the goal of imposing radical Islam on the nations of the world. In fact, these attacks had begun long before, in 1954, with the assassination attempt against President Gamal Nasser in Egypt. And these attacks continued in the 1981 assassination of Anwar Sadat, and then with this list of attacks against the United States. All right, that's the background. Solutions. Number one, superior military force is the only method proven method of curbing terrorism. And I think it's morally right for good governments to capture and, if need be, kill hardened terrorist supporters, according to Romans 13. Traditional law enforcement methods are not suitable. That is, if you blow up an airplane or a bus, we'll capture you and put you in prison. And the terrorist says, hey, I'm already going to be dead. I don't care. So,
I get extra
virgins. So there has to be a prevention ahead of the attack. Solution number one, Islamic force. Number two, what about wiretapping? We had two effective weapons against terrorism that were compromised. First, secretly, we could trace interbank transfers of funds, even in overseas banks. We could trace terrorist funding and then find where it was going and then prevent the attack. Sadly, unfortunately, tragically, the New York Times exposed that in a news story on June 23rd, 2006. So all of a sudden we couldn't trace those funds secretly anymore. Why'd the New York Times do that? Well, it wasn't to help the United States, that's for sure. I think it was treasonous, and I think it should have been prosecuted. Then we had another method. What the terrorists didn't know was, even if they're calling on a cell phone from one foreign country to another foreign country, from Afghanistan to Saudi Arabia, or Afghanistan to Pakistan even, Afghanistan to Egypt, if they're calling on a cell phone, those calls were routed through equipment in the United States just because of the way the international telephone system is set up. So we could listen to those calls, and they didn't know it. And if there were calls from Afghanistan to Los Angeles, to a certain neighborhood in Los Angeles, a whole bunch of calls from Afghanistan, all of a sudden our forces could concentrate on that neighborhood in Los Angeles to discover a terror plot before it occurred. Go down to number eight. This top secret program of listening to terrorist phone conversations was recklessly exposed by the New York Times December 16th, 2005. Even though they admitted in their article that this program was successful. Again, I think that's treasonous betrayal of the security interests of the United States and should have been prosecuted as such, that exposure by the New York Times. Not a newspaper dedicated to the good of the United States in these instances, it seems to me. Go back up to number six. Liberal opponents of this program said that warrantless wiretapping violated Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and civil rights. But when it's been tested in court, every appeals court has found that the President of the United States has the authority to gather electronic intelligence. Now, you got a 2-minute phone call from Osama bin Laden to someplace in Saudi Arabia or someplace in Los Angeles. Are you supposed to go to the local judge and say, oh, we need a warrant to listen in on this phone call? And 5 or 6 hours later, you get the warrant back, maybe on an expedited basis, or if it's the middle of the night, it might be 12 hours later. But the phone call only lasted 2 minutes. What good does your warrant do? So all this complaint about warrantless wiretapping, I think, was just a smokescreen, again, to attempt to prevent the United States from having effective measures against terrorist attacks. Number nine, the primary opposition to this program of following interbank transfers and wiretapping terrorist calls was from the American Civil Liberties Union and many liberal Democratic members of Congress. Finally, after a huge struggle, in July 12th of 2008, President Bush was able to get a bill through Congress that said the phone companies would be immune from lawsuits for helping the United States in anti-terror efforts. And that was necessary, otherwise they wouldn't do it or they'd be bankrupted by lawsuits. I think that that program is essential to national security, a small threat to the invasion of privacy of ordinary citizens. Solution number three, holding nations accountable that harbor terrorists. Here's the deal. Why could terrorist training bases prosper in Iraq? Because Saddam Hussein gave his blessing and support to them. Why could terrorist training bases prosper in Afghanistan? Because the Taliban was controlling the government and allowed it to be there. Pakistan, we're hoping for more help from Pakistan, but still terrorists are there because the government hasn't fully cracked down on them. When you have governments that do not tolerate terrorist activities, friends and neighbors say, hey, there's a lot of suspicious activity. Why are these people carrying all this fertilizer into this building or something like that? People know. Once a nation is committed to outlawing this and opposed to it, then the substantial amounts of terrorist threat can be stopped. Why is Hamas able to prosper in Gaza? Because they control the government. So when nations start helping us, and many did after President Bush said, if you're harboring them, you are our enemy as well, that was a great help. Number four, next page, persuading people in Muslim nations to turn against terrorist groups. Now, here's another really excellent book, How the Tide Was Turned in Iraq. It's called Moment of Truth in Iraq by Michael Yon, Y-O-N. He's a former Army Green Beret who's a journalist, and he tells the story about how two things had to happen in Iraq in order to gain peace and security there to the extent that it has happened. Number one, we had to have strong military presence in neighborhood after neighborhood so people felt safe and they weren't going to be killed by Al-Qaeda forces. And then just helping people with ordinary medical needs or food supply needs or water or just ordinary help, gaining confidence. But we needed a strong military presence. And then use of local contacts and charitable acts. First, military presence, and then second, using charitable acts to build trust and confidence. And Michael Yon said he thinks it's going to work in Iraq if we don't withdraw and all of a sudden abandon these people's needs for security in all these local villages and things. Number H, solution. Two others, and Gene Moore told me last week that this number five and number six should be number one and number two, and I can understand why he's saying that, because you can hear what happens when I mention these. Number five, moral reformation in American culture. Moral breakdown in the United States gives Islamic radicals intellectual ammunition. If you think Qutb was horrified at the moral state of the United States in 1948, what do you think he would have thought if he visited today, saw our movie theaters, saw our television, saw our newsstands, and saw our high school students and many, many other things? So moral reformation in the United States is needed, and that has come about historically when pastors have proclaimed the moral law of God as something to which God holds everyone accountable. And then number six, just proclaiming God's laws won't do the trick unless there is genuine spiritual revival, a genuine moral transformation so that people's hearts want to do what is right. A spiritual revivalist in the United States, revival in the United States, would take away Islamists' ability to claim the high moral ground. And I would hope that if such a revival comes, it will reach even hardened Islamic terrorists in this country and in other countries. So six solutions. Now let's see. Probably you can read the rest of the outline for yourselves. I'm saying I think the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were just wars and are just wars, according to the just war standards that I gave a few weeks ago. I think they were basically wars to defend ourselves against a very widely diffuse and scattered enemy that was bent on our destruction. And I've got some data there about whether this was a just cause or not. My concern, is point, next to the last point on the whole outline, my present concern is that Afghanistan and Iraq may still now be lost by President Obama if he does not commit to sufficient military forces. We say, how long do we have to leave our forces there in Iraq and Afghanistan? Well, I don't know, but I don't think we should say we're going to get them home by September of next year, because all of a sudden the Taliban will just wait in Afghanistan and say, fine, we won't spend much of our time attacking you now, but in September we're going at it with a vengeance. And how long have we had troops in Germany? Since 1945, I guess, end of World War II. How long have we had troops in South Korea? Since 1952 or so. But there's still a contingent there, and South Korea is free, and Germany's free. So, I don't think we should weaken in our resolve to maintain democracies there. Both Iraq and Afghanistan have had democratic elections, huge percentage of the people in the countries voting, and they're still functioning as fledgling democracies today. Okay, we have a few minutes for interaction. Okay, John Butel over here.
All right.
John, and I guess Jason has a mic as well. Okay, right here, John.
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering, who would you, and how would you define Allah? I know it's a biggie, but yeah. Are we talking about a different viewpoint of the same God? Or are we talking about two different...
How tall are you, John?
6'5".
Okay. So if I say, well, I said hello to John at church this morning. He was 5'4". He was 23 years old. He was single. And he was an accountant. Am I describing the same John as you?
No.
Same name?
Yeah.
Different characteristics?
Okay. Okay, good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, the problem of what to call God in Bible translations in country Arabic countries, I'm not sure. I need more knowledge of the language. What's your name?
Mari.
Oh, Mari. How are you? I'm not seeing you well back there.
Since Europe is now becoming more and more Muslim and invaded by Arab people, or inhabited by Arab people.
Yeah.
Do you think it's a paradox that you see the anti-Americanism, but you also see the invasion of Muslim people in European countries?
Yeah.
Wouldn't they kind of... How do you think that they... What do you think that that's going on behind that?
Maria, I don't know. Do you have? I know you're from Norway, so do you have ideas yourself?
Well, I know that great parts of Europe, in fact, Oslo in Norway, where I'm from, is now pure Muslim parts of that city.
Yeah.
I know that there's, at the same time, there's this very liberal, social. It's heading in a very liberal direction.
Yep.
So
yep.
It's kind of a paradox in my mind. You're seeing they're on one hand criticizing the invasion,
yep.
And the other hand they're criticizing America. So
yep.
it doesn't really hold together in my mind.
I understand.
I don't understand that paradox.
I don't think that I have a very good explanation for what's going on in Europe, and we see it in England. Margaret and I have been in England quite a bit too. One thought I have is that Marxism, communism, was the theory that the wealthy people are just oppressing the poor and wealth is evil and property is evil. And that's been largely discredited, but there's kind of a transformation of Marxist thinking now that anybody who has power or success has to be evil.
I think that is in Norway particularly, since socialism
yep.
kind of works there because it's a small country with mainly people that think alike.
Yep.
And
are hardworking by nature.
And are hardworking and really benefit from
yep.
from pulling the ship, you know, the
yep.
the cart together.
Yep.
So I think that they still believe that, you know, that
yep.
in a sense we need to help them.
But the question is how to explain the anti-American sentiment in Europe, which is strong. And I think it may be this theory that people who have power and success are evil. And the United States has great power and great success. Therefore, in the universities, it's just taught to them that this has to be evil. And so they're kind of programmed to oppose the United States. But yet the imposition of Islamic law, it goes contrary to that. But there's just plain fear. Fear of violence, and then lack of moral backbone to stand up to what's happening in the Netherlands, for instance, where people are put to death for drawing cartoons of Muhammad and things like that. So, yeah, big question. Yep.
Song time.
Okay, I'm going to go another few minutes. Go ahead.
Oh, if a death cult like Al Qaeda sprang up in Christendom. Christians would be in the forefront of helping to destroy it.
Yep.
If jihadism...
discredited.
Yeah, if jihadism is indeed a minority opinion,
yep.
why don't we see anti-Al-Qaeda groups springing up in the Islamic world?
Fear? Possibly fear of being killed? Some people try it and they have to... Yeah, yeah. But what's your name?
David.
We really need that to happen. We really need the vast majority of Muslims that I think don't believe in this kind of violence. I don't know how big the majority is, but majority. We need them to drive out this radical viewpoint from Islam. But you see, Nasser tried it in Egypt, and he just couldn't stamp it out. And Sadat tried it in Egypt, tried appeasing them, tried giving them government positions, couldn't stamp it out, tried putting them in prison, couldn't stamp it out. It's a demonic motivation. Ultimately, it has great power. And I think prayer and spread of the Christian gospel are going to be the ultimate solution, along with strong military and laws on the part of freedom-loving nations. Okay, I haven't gone over here. I've got John and Rose. Okay, we've got three more, and let's do quickly. And then I didn't look at this side at all before. I'm sorry, Keith. John Blackman over here.
Wayne, can I interrupt here?
Yep.
While you're waiting?
Yep.
I don't know if any of you got to talk to Captain Sean when he was here on his leave from Afghanistan. He's a member of the Powhatan class and
yep.
very
okay.
dear
yep.
member of the congregation. He's been over there for a second tour.
Yep.
And I was absolutely horrified about his opinion. The first tour, the second tour, totally, totally different.
Really?
Yeah, and he says now that we've lost the war.
Because of our commitment to pull out?
That's the biggest thing that's happening is the Taliban are going around telling the people that used to be snitching
yeah.
on them
yeah.
that, hey, these guys are going to leave here next
yep.
year and we're going to come kill you.
Yep.
And he said all the people that were talking to them now
yep.
are pulling back.
Amazing. See, and that's what worries me. And who is influencing President Obama's policy on this? It's Jim Wallace that I was criticizing in the lecture earlier. It's this liberal pacifist version of Christian teaching that I think is so destructive and says, oh no, we just pull back and it's our fault and we don't have the moral right and we get out and we lose that war. My goodness, that's going to be trouble.
Well, he says that Karzai's government is probably going down and that we're going to end up seeing
yeah.
the warlords, you know, one of them
yeah.
being the Taliban, take
yeah.
over the country
and,
again.
And General McChrystal asked for 62,000 troops and Obama sent 30,000. Or he asked for 60 and they sent 32, something
it's
like that.
It's depressing.
Yeah. Okay, John?
Just a quick one. Islamic jihadism is a minority view. Does right suggest the definition of minority? I've heard some pretty big numbers.
Yeah. It worries me too, John. He doesn't say. I hope it's a minority. I think it is because there are millions of Muslims in Turkey and Indonesia, in many Muslim countries in the Middle East who work with us and, you know, aren't promoting violence, so I hope. But I brought another article. It's very worrisome. What's happened in Iraq? Persecution of Christians now. So once Muslims become a majority, it says there were 100,000 Christians in Mosul, Iraq. Now it's down to 5,000 because of persecution. So that's really worrisome. And what you're saying here about the need for moderate Muslims to rise up and defeat this by whatever means is very strong. I understand that. Okay, what's your name?
Sharon.
Sharon? Okay, we'll do Sharon and Rose and be done.
We'd like to know the background of Jim Wallis.
And Jim Wallis?
Also, the name of his book again.
Was, he's in his 60s. He's an anti-Vietnam War demonstrator from the 60s. He's an Episcopal priest. I think he's a priest, or his wife is a priest. He's Episcopalian, liberal Episcopalian. He did go to seminary, and he went to a conservative seminary, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, where I formerly taught, but I wasn't there when he was there, but the memory of him lingered because he was apparently a troublemaker on campus even when he went there. So he has a seminary degree, but I think he's just profoundly mistaken on his pacifist views and his blame America views. Rose?
You were talking about the, quote, good Muslims. Why are they not rising and defending? I have the feeling that they feel the exact same way as the ones who are doing all the dirty work.
Some.
And they are just kind of sitting back and waiting to enjoy the fruit of their labor of those who are actually doing the killing.
Maybe, at least
Except
on the part of
some. Except there's one lady, I can't think of her name, but she's on Fox News, and boy, is she anti-Muslim, and she herself is a Muslim.
The former member of parliament from the Netherlands.
Is she? I don't know her name.
Yeah, well, anyway, there are a few courageous ones, We need to pray for more. Okay. Merry Christmas. I didn't want to beat around the bush. I mean, this is just what the situation in the world is today. It's a great threat facing us. We need to be thankful to God that He's protected us from any great terrorist attacks succeeding in the time since 9/11. And we know what the ultimate future is. Christ is going to come back, isn't He? He's going to reign over the earth. Perfect peace and perfect righteousness. I'm going to pray. Our Lord, we thank You that You are indeed sovereign over the entire earth, and that the destinies of nations and kingdoms are in Your hands. We ask for Your mercy, Lord. We know our great failings and sins as a people, and yet we ask for Your mercy on the world and on our nation, and that You would cause Your gospel to spread in power and triumph and change hearts, and even change the hearts of those committed to such violent advance of a religion that turns people not to You but away from You. We commit ourselves into Your hands now, and we thank You for this Christmas season. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. See you in 2 weeks. No class next week.